Let's talk about iOS 13.5, which is an all-new version of iOS that we did.
Slow down, Zach. Slow down.
Not know about until this week.
What about 13.4.5? That's got to come out, right?
What version are we even on right now? Like,
so the shipping version is 13.4.2, right?
13.4.2. Okay.
Yeah.
So we're going to take a boost to go to 13.4.5, and it came out when 13.4.1 was the latest version. That's when yes. 0.5 was coming. So this includes the new, what was called contact tracing API. Now they're calling it exposure notification API because it sells better. And
it's more accurate.
Okay. And I think it's more specific. Yeah. But you go, so you go from 0.45 to 13.5 as the version. And it's because of that big new feature inside that they say that that's why they changed it. So,
because yeah, if they add API, then at the developer level, mm-hmm. you can say, like, if I'm currently running on 13.4 or 13.5, access this new stuff, but you haven't got the granularity to say, like, if I'm running at 13.4.1, do the same thing. Like, the little, like, availability modifiers aren't there for, yeah. like, the point releases.
So in this case, it's not just the marketing name, but it's a functional mm-hmm. difference when you get yeah. to that. Okay.
And yeah. That's never really clocked for me before today, but that's why sometimes there's updates which are, like, 0.1. And then they feel so minor, but yeah. they must have just like one tiny little API change that then means they have to bump the number up so much.
That makes sense. Yeah. Okay. Mm. Well,
this obviously will, when this comes out and they've said they're aiming to get the exposure notification stuff out in mid-May, you get the new setting screens for the exposure notification. And it's kind of weird because when you upgrade to 13.5, at least in the current beta, which, if it's coming out in mid-May, there's only going to be this and maybe one more beta of it before it actually ships. Right. Because the timeline's compressed like that. So at the moment, the way it works is you upgrade to 13.5 and then nothing changes. But if you go into settings, privacy, health, there's now a new section for which says COVID-19 exposure notifications, and the toggle's switched on by default. And there's this very confusing like paragraph of copy beneath it that doesn't really explain what's going on. Because, you know, through the press briefings and the explanations that Apple gave about contact tracing, as they called it then, like a month ago, what we know is that it's opt-in mm-hmm. and that no data is collected and you don't participate until you explicitly opt in. But it's kind of awkward that the setting is toggled on and it looks green. So the reality is, even with the setting on, nothing's happening until you go and download an app from the App Store, which has... Right. the contact tracing or the exposure notification API integrated, and Apple's only going to approve apps from registered health providers or mm-hmm. And basically that's going to be like the national health unit or institution for your region. And like you reported before, didn't you, that there's only going to be like one app per region, right?
Right,
so
right.
it's not even like a free for all where you have to trust like a random indie developer, or do you want to use their contact tracing? Do you want to use their... That's not going to happen. It's like the UK will have one medical app that supports the contact tracing API, and you'll be able to find it in the App Store and download it. And then when you launch that app, it will then come up with another prompt that says, do you actually want to start using exposure notifications? And that, and so that's like an alert dialog similar to like location services mm-hmm. where it pops up and it says, do you want to allow this app to share your random identifiers and report through? And then you can say allow or deny. And it's only at that point that the data is actually being collected.
Yeah. It's at least a bad UI the way that it's exposed right now
in
the beta, because the copy below, so you've got COVID-19 exposure notifications, and then you've got a toggle, which is green, so it means on. And then below that, the copy reads, iPhone is using Bluetooth to securely share your random IDs with nearby devices and collect their IDs. So at no part of that do you think, my iPhone isn't a part of this program. You think it is. And this enables an app to notify you if you may have been exposed to COVID-19. Random IDs are deleted after 14 days. Apps you authorize can notify you if you're exposed to COVID-19. You can also choose to anonymously share your COVID-19 diagnosis. So none of that really makes it clear that, I mean, what we know is that you have to have an app. The app will have its own permission layer. But if they're going to go with that copy and that label for the toggle, then it needs to be off. Like, you know how I think it's in the passcode settings where like there's some things in there that are toggled off, and that's the way that you use the feature. Like,
yeah, because they kind of flip the way they're worded. So some of them are like, enable it to do this, and other ones are check the box to turn it off.
Like lightning accessories is one of the things.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And that's kind of slightly annoying worded as well, for that matter.
Yeah.
But yeah, one way they could address this is to just not show that screen in the privacy settings until you download an app that uses the API.
Yeah. And it's pretty buried in there.
Device will know about this because it's all restricted and it's not a free-for-all. All the apps have to have special entitlements. So when you download them, they have to have a little tag in the thing that says this actually uses this API and it's allowed to use it, and that's the method by which Apple stops, you know, any random game from adopting the same thing.
Yeah.
So the phone would know whether it's got an app installed or not. And so that's probably the best way to do it, where they just don't show the settings at all unless you download the app.
Yeah, it's so important here that this is the first, they call this beta 3, but it's the first beta with this feature. And I really hope they take the feedback in this and like improve that one section, if nothing else, because regular users are already going to be skeptical of this feature because it's hard to communicate that it doesn't use location, that it's strictly Bluetooth and it's kind of like blind. It's got like no map and no vision.
Yeah. I think the copy is almost like jumping the gun, and it's kind of describing the phase 2 behavior.
Sure,
which Apple has said, you know, in a few months time, they're going to integrate contact tracing at the OS level. And then there will be some, like the collection of identifiers that does happen without you having to have the app installed.
That's right.
In phase 2, you still need the app to report yourself as positive, because then that gets sent off to the doctor or the health professional who have to verify it before it gets distributes the notifications.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, you know, that could be 4 or 5 months away.
But in phase 2, would that be on or off? Because I think it would be off.
It should be off.
Yeah.
If you follow the spec to the letter,
yeah,
it should be off by default.
Yeah. Because there was some confusion with what we showed and how it works, and so it's important that this is a beta version. And
either the text below the little toggle should say when you have a supported app installed, then this happens, or they should just like have the toggle off until you download the app, you say allow, and then it turns the toggle on, or you just don't show the screen at all until you have an app installed. They're Apple. I'm sure they can figure it out. But.
Yeah. And it's important. I can't say it enough. It's important to know that this is the beta version. May is when they say they're gonna release this stuff officially. Because there's no apps that use it yet. But now it's in the beta version, so that developers for like the CDC and the NHS can test their app on a real device running the actual software. I think they said mid-May, and so there's also confusion about will this be on May 1st, Friday, or, you know, it's going to be in a few weeks' time.
Yeah, and getting the details right and making it very clear is very important, because there's already so much fake news, confusion, debate, discussion about this exact same thing.
Yeah.
Like, people are already, there's, you know, you've got several countries adopting the Apple API. You had Germany said they didn't want to and they wanted to do a centralized model, but then they changed their mind a week later.
Yeah.
You've got countries like the UK and the NHS saying they don't want to use the decentralized model. They want to have the centralized model because it's going to give them a bit more data collection. I think that's a mistake because, you know, that going on your own means you don't get to take advantage of the benefits of the API, which include performance and efficiency, right? So because it's baked in at the OS level, the data collection is activated when you install the app, but it doesn't have to actually fully wake the app up to do the data collection. So it's much better for your battery, and the actual identification and cross-referencing happens locally on your device. So it's also much more privacy preserving, and either a combination of those two factors is going to reduce the amount of people who want to opt into it. And, you know, for the system to have any effect, you want wide adoption. So hopefully the NHS changed their mind, because they're like one of the big laggards at the moment. I don't know what the US is planning at the moment. I think the US is going like state by state or something, right?
I think
the last I saw is they weren't going to do like a nationwide one. They're it's the US, they've got like different states doing different things.
Yeah, let's just that's unfortunate, but it's also how this is has played out anyway, is like let's just do 50 different versions of the same thing.
I'm sure the UK, what will probably happen with the UK app is it will come out, everyone will complain that it drains the battery too fast, and then they'll change their mind and adopt the Apple and Google recommended system. And they're getting a lot of flack for not doing it already. So we'll see what happens there.
Yeah. And it's not just iOS 13.5. It's also, there's also a version of, I guess, is it a preview of the Google Play Store update that will have this? So there's a way to test this on Android as well.
Yeah. Because Android will be part of it. Side as well,
yeah. Nice. And like iOS 13.5 is kind of the COVID-19 release, because it's not just the API for exposure notifications, but it's also two specific features that are kind of an answer to a problem or you know, concern in iOS since shelter in place orders have been in effect and people have had to wear masks to reduce sharing germs, you know, if you're infected and you don't know it. And so the first change is that there's a new process with unlocking your phone with iOS 13.5 beta, where it seems to detect if you're wearing a mask and it'll suggest using your passcode before failing to unlock with Face ID. And it's a smart feature where it doesn't always go this way now. Like, it doesn't like passcode first for everybody because of this, but it's, if it detects a mask, then it will suggest using your passcode, right?
Yeah, I think it's probably a bit cruder than like actually looking for a mask if your face is like partially obscured.
Sure, yeah.
I didn't have a mask to hand, so I was just like putting my hand all over my face trying to see what different things were happening. And because if you swipe up on the phone when you're not looking at the device at all, it still has that normal delay. And it's definitely looking for some kind of face presence. But I think maybe if your like nose is covered or your mouth's covered, then it does this new thing where it just shows the password screen instantly rather than where the old way where it would sit, you know, waiting for you to adjust yourself to try and make the Face ID work for like mm-hmm. 3 or 4 more seconds. And in a normal world where people weren't wearing masks all the time, that was probably the right trade-off because it's nicer for you to just go, okay, I'll adjust my view, I'll get Face ID to work.
Yeah.
Whereas at the moment, you know, the hit rate is inverted and a lot more people just need to be able to type their passcode in as quickly as possible.
Yeah. You know, on the iPad Pro 2018 and later, they have it built into the feature that if it knows that your finger is covering the camera, like you get a message about that. It's like, you know, your finger is covering the camera. Here's an arrow pointing to it.
Yeah, because they put the camera in a stupid place when you're holding the iPad in landscape.
Yeah. And then they made a keyboard that makes it that way all the time.
The COVID situation does kind of show why a future where the iPhone only supports facial biometrics is kind of unstable. Mm. And like in the current world, it means so many more people are using masks, but even in a normal environment, there are, you know, religions, mm-hmm. ethnic groups, different countries that still wear masks on a daily basis normally.
Sure.
And if you've been inconvenienced by, you know, your iPhone Face ID in recent months, just imagine what people are like who have to live with all the time. So yeah. I think it does show that in the long run, an iPhone that has, you know, both Touch ID and Face ID that work alongside each other, like you can unlock with either and you register both and then whichever one triggers first just unlocks your phone. So it's not like a multi-layer step and it's not slower. If anything, it's faster because, you know, and you just do what's convenient. Like Face ID is great. It really is. But, mm-hmm. you know, those downsides are annoying and they come in different situations, just like how Touch ID had downsides, like when you had wet fingers and it just wouldn't mm-hmm. scan. And in those cases, Face ID can make up for Touch ID's shortcomings. So hopefully a multi-auth iPhone is forthcoming. And there are some rumors that it's going to happen sooner, maybe next year, that mm-hmm. it's going to be underscreen Touch ID alongside Face ID as well. And we even have rumors of that weird like iPhone SE 2 Plus thing that doesn't have Face ID, but it adopts a fingerprint in the power button. So there's a lot of stuff in the air circling about that kind of thing.
Yeah. So the difference between iPhone and Android handsets is that on Android handsets, sometimes they don't have the same sophistication as Face ID in terms of biometric security, but they've got facial recognition to unlock your phone. But they've also got the equivalent of Touch ID behind, not under the screen, but behind the phone, on the rear side of the phone.
And a few devices do have underscreen Touch ID now as well.
And they do have the new stuff, right? And so Apple's been against putting Touch ID on the back because, well, for one, Android was already putting it there because a lot of the phones didn't have the same bezel in the front that allowed you to put that there. And so there's something kind of nice about it, I think, where it was placed with your finger and everything, if you held it the right way. But with the SE 2 plus or whatever you want to call it, you know, the larger, the first time there's been a lower market phone that's redesigned, it seems, having it in the power button. I mean, people have wondered if that would be possible even now. And if that's more reliable or more consistent than even under the screen, then just putting it as many places as possible seems like the way to go. And it would, I think it'd be really weird if they had that on the SE and not on like the Pro phones as an option too. But is the difference there that the redesigned SE wouldn't have Face ID, but it would just be bezel-less?
Correct.
And so you still get one version. You don't get both on a phone. Yeah, if they did that. So,
and if that is happening next year, that is supposedly the same year when the high-end phones would have both. Mm. And obviously the SE equivalent is getting it in the power button because it's cheaper.
Yeah.
Whereas the high-end phones would get it under the screen, the touch, the fingerprint recognition.
Right. Yeah. And what's also new in iOS 13.5 as of this beta this week is related to people having to work from home and do these group video calls and telework. And it's that they've changed the way – they've added a new option for group FaceTime. And so now you can opt out of having all of the videos float around and change sizes based on who's talking. How's this work, Mayo?
Yeah, so they still float. They just don't move anymore.
Okay.
So, so the UI looks the same if you took a screenshot of it. But what would happen since group FaceTime was introduced in iOS 12.1 is that there would be like some machine learning algorithm, some computer smart thing that it would try and work out who's talking and who's the focus of the conversation at that moment. And that person's avatar would grow and get bigger and everyone else would shrink to the sides. And then someone else talks and the focus shifts and the other one will grow larger. And you could always like double tap on the person's face if you wanted to specifically do it manually and control it yourself. But by default, and there was no way to turn this off before, it would just move around constantly. And if you have a group call, like group FaceTime supports up to 32 people.
Yes.
Often, when there's more than like three people in a chat at once, some people start talking to each other. There's people responding and interjections, and it would just cause the thing to go a bit haywire and everything would be moving around constantly. I actually noticed this on Oprah's show on Apple TV Plus, the COVID-19 talk show.
Yeah.
They would have like an interview basically with like three or four different people, and it was kind of like nauseating having the icons move around so much, like the people's face would get bigger and smaller. And while it was technically like doing the right thing, like it was focusing on the person who was primarily speaking, it's just kind of unnatural to like constantly seeing these things flit around. And having this setting is good because it lets you just turn that off. And when you turn it off, all the grid just stays static and you don't get the automatic zooming going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's an intelligent feature that can get tricked by the way people use group video chat. And so over the weekend, I did my first, I've done two Zoom calls over this period. One was with friends at their request. And then the other one was the Infinity Science Center near where I live. They had like this rocket class in January or so that I went to, and it was the first of its kind. And then they had an Apollo 13 class that had to be virtual. And so it was by Zoom, and there were about 25, 30 attendees. So it could have fit in group FaceTime if everyone was on an iPhone or an Apple device. But where that fell apart was that like FaceTime, it puts emphasis on the person speaking as an option, at least. And not everyone knows to mute their microphone.
Mm-hmm.
And so there could be background noise, and then you'd have someone's avatar without even having a video take over, and there's lots of options to like the way that you can view Zoom and how it shows. But what would happen for me is, if I didn't lock in the main speaker, then I would have like background noise tiles come up. And so that's the same thing with FaceTime, is it might actually be the person speaking. The way that they've got this in the settings for iOS 13.5 is under FaceTime. It's under automatic prominence and then speaking. And I guess the default is turned on to work as it always has.
Correct.
And then to change it, to turn it off. And they say during group FaceTime calls, the tile of the person speaking will automatically become larger. So it's to turn that off is to opt out of that. So I haven't tried this. I use group FaceTime occasionally. We mentioned here before.
I use group FaceTime I use FaceTime one-to-one quite regularly.
Me too.
The opportunity for like group calls doesn't come up as much.
Coordinating who was available at that moment is harder, but
yeah. And they try and like counter it by letting you just like put the little bubble in like a group messages chat. But
yeah.
I don't know. It's kind of like rude to do that. You know what I mean?
Well,
like, don't want to join or whatever.
If you could, here's a feature request of sorts, I guess, is that if you could do, when you do a one-on-one call, it's the full screen of that person plus you in a picture-in-picture. And once you go to a group FaceTime, even if a third person doesn't answer, then they're a square and you're a square.
Yep.
And so it's not full screen anymore. It's over, you're floating or you're stagnant. If you could go back to that, like the last person hangs up or the third person hangs up, it's back to two again, then have full screen, then it'd be a lot cooler.
Yeah. And obviously, they've had to rush this setting in because clearly a lot more people are using group FaceTime and a lot of people complain about it, maybe including Apple executives themselves.
Sure.
But the core UI is still the same, where it's still the asymmetric arrangement.
Yeah.
And, you know, in a perfect world, they probably should have an option for just like a more traditional grid layout, which is like what Zoom has, right? Where it's just kind of like just a you know, a diagonal regular. You've got squares and your faces fit in them. And, you know, there's no fancy zooming around, but a lot more people just are kind of used to that old way. And I kind of like the way they do the design. It makes it a bit more interesting. But if you're just trying to do, it does make it feel more like something you're doing for fun rather than something you're doing seriously, right? And so even just from the aesthetics of that, if you're trying to like get group face to be more popular in like business settings, you probably just want an option which makes it as boring as possible.
Sure. Right? Yeah. Something else this week, you know, last time we spoke, Mayo, I had the Magic Keyboard for iPad Pro, the 11-inch, and I'd had it for less than 24 hours, including sleep. And so I gave you my first impressions of it. I've since been using it. You know, I'm still in that phase where I'm using it in the keyboard more than I think I will long term. Because I really enjoy taking the iPad out and just using it as a tablet. And the first time I did that after like 4 days of using it in the case, I was like, oh, this is, you know, it's really nice. It's like just the screen in my hand. So that was cool. But I think eventually I'll get to a point where it's like just practical. Do I need the keyboard and trackpad or stand function, or do I just need the tablet? You know, so I'm coming around there. But I went back and spent a few minutes with the Smart Keyboard Folio for the iPad, because I still have the one for the 11-inch that my wife used before. And so it, you know, it fits except for the camera cutout gets obscured, but you know, it's just to try it out. And I've for a moment I was like, maybe this is better for me. I quickly came around, but, there were things about it that were easier with the Smart Keyboard Folio, that I like that aren't true of the Magic Keyboard. And so, a few things here. The Smart Keyboard Folio is easier to open because it's not heavy, you know, it's just the little flap versus like a big base that's magnetically, you know, sealed anyway. The Magic Keyboard is easier to close because you just like push it down and you don't have to like reverse origami the thing. So it's like they're even there. Then the next thing is, with the Smart Keyboard Folio, the screen can be closer to you. So it's like larger because there's just not as much in between you. But then with the Magic Keyboard Folio, it's more adjustable. So you've got, you know, the in between viewing angles and everything. And I think I mentioned it last time and you were like kind of challenged this, but I thought that the position where the Magic Keyboard is flat on the magnet cover without any kind of hanging parts to it, because it wasn't even like 45 degrees, it was less than that. It was like 40 degrees or so, that I didn't think it'd be practical. But then I got to like the weekend and I was like using the iPad on my chest, like in bed or, you know, like on the couch. And it's like, oh, and then I realized I do use my MacBook a lot that way too, like where it's more closed than not. So that's a very practical.
It's not like you want it to be super sharp, but it's just those couple of extra degrees that make it less convenient. Yeah.
And it's good having that as a supported, you know, degree of opening without it shutting on its own, because if you did it any more than that, it would close on its own. So you know, toss it there. The using the Smart Keyboard Folio again with just touch input and a trackpad, all of a sudden I was much happier using Control Center and Notification Center and how they are, where you just grab them down. You know, and I still think that, like, you know, there needs to be some changes there with cursor mode, especially having the Notification Center not be full screen, you know, having it just be a part. But just gesture wise, it felt better. And as far as all the gestures go, within a couple of days of just using them repeatedly, I got used to it. Where none were a challenge anymore, because the first, you know, day I was definitely found myself challenged in using, you know, how do I activate Control Center in this corner. Sure. And I think I was trying to use momentum as part of it, or the corner as part of it, but it's more like the top corner, but the top of the screen part is what activates it. And then the double down gesture to get back to the home screen from the dock, you know, from an app is became intuitive too. So, just getting used to that muscle memory. And then I did have a little bit of, like, you know, it was nice using the iPad without a cursor as a change. And so then I was thinking, like, do I really need a cursor with the iPad, or is it really practical? And then when I went back to using the Magic Keyboard with the cursor, things like gestures to scroll the screen without obscuring this, touching the screen or having your hand in the way, I liked that a lot. And, you can just be more precise that way. And just for like passive browsing, I think it's just much better, like I mentioned last week. And then I did something that a couple of days ago that I hadn't done before and it just felt ridiculous. Opening the camera app with a cursor. Like, that's an app made for touch. Like,
yeah.
It feels silly to use it with a cursor. But anyway, that's what I've got since last week.
Like it definitely shines in those kind of passive environments where, you're just scrolling the web and it feels kind of stupid that if you've got your laptop screen vertical that you then should lift your arm up to touch the screen.
Yeah.
And that was what Apple always rolls out when they say, why don't they do a touchscreen MacBook? It's like, you don't want to do vertical touching. But then at the same time, they'd always have an iPad in a case, which always put the screen vertical.
Yeah.
So adding the trackpad on there kind of answers that question, kind of, in a way. Yeah. But I do think do you remember like a couple of months ago when we were just talking about what kind of pointer support there could be? And I envisioned that just like, it still looks like a keyboard, but you can do kind of two-finger scrolling around.
Yeah.
I still kind of feel kind of validated that would be like address 95% of what people want to do with a trackpad on the iPad. Because I've been using the Logitech Combo One a bit more. And, for the passive scrolling up and down, I don't really need the full trackpad there. And the trackpads are pretty small anyway, because they have to be to fit in the space. So if you could just have like the whole keyboard be a two-finger trackpad, and you just use it for like scrolling websites or, editing text, I think that'd be pretty valuable, and it'd probably reduce the overall weight of everything. But obviously they didn't go in that direction.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's like a stupid idea, even, when now the proof's in the pudding with the thing they shipped.
Yeah. Something else that was ridiculous was opening the Apple TV remote app and controlling that with a cursor. Cause then you're controlling tvOS with a cursor basically. And it's by clicking and dragging to make it move around. And, you couldn't really do that because it confuses like the click and drag as click and hold, which then rearranges your apps, so it was silly. But, if you've got one of these things, then there are some things that you can do that are kind of ridiculous. My wife Kelsey, she instantly wanted one whenever she tried mine. She used the Bridge keyboard case that made it like a MacBook. This thing, I think, is lighter than what she used. And then also for her, it was like, I want the new thing because of the trackpad. And then she does, she uses her iPad for school. She's a nurse, but she's also going to school to get to advance her degree. And, so she uses like heavily for that stuff, but then she also uses it for gaming that I don't really do. She's been playing like a SimCity game with it. And I was like, why aren't you using your cursor, your trackpad for that? And she was like, well, it's just easier for games to use your finger and everything because of how it's designed. So, it's kind of neat seeing one used not just by me, but by her too. So, that's what I've got for that this week. But I'm, for a moment I was like, maybe I should get one of these, the Smart Keyboard Folio that's made for this iPad with a keyboard cutout. And then I was like, no. And I went back to the Smart Keyboard again. I was like, or the Magic Keyboard. And I was like, this is definitely the superior product. And there's a reason, like, it's $300 instead of $200, which is admittedly overpriced too for this folio.
Yeah, like all of Apple's keyboards are too expensive.
Yes.
But that's the environment we live in.
Yes. I think it's for the 11 inches, like 80 for a Smart Cover Folio, 180 for the Smart Keyboard Folio, and then 300 for the this Magic Keyboard. Yeah,
so. It's definitely a jump up. Like, ideally, it would end at the 180 point, not that be the middle option.
Yeah, really. What were the price of like Smart Covers before they had the folio part? Like, they were like maybe 60. So,
the leather ones were 60, and then the plastic, like rubber ones, were like 45.
Yeah, polyurethane. Yeah.
Yeah.
Those are the days.
Those were the days.
Yeah.
That was still like my favorite cover on it, because I had the iPad 2 and it was like perfectly designed for that Smart Cover.
Yep.
And although I was too cheap at the time, so I had the dull gray Smart Cover.
I did the green one, the polyurethane that was like lime green colored, and it came before the iPad came, and I put it on the fridge.
Didn't do black or any like decent color. So you either had like, iPhone 5C colors with like blue or green or whatever, and then their own like neutral color was just like ugly gray, and that's for whatever reason that's what I chose.
Now that's all you can get. If you want a keyboard on it. All right.
No, but this was ugly gray.
Ugly gray.
The modern gray is nicer.
It was like light gray.
Yeah, it was light gray. It was like it was like Windows 95 gray.
It was like off-brand gray. Yeah.
Yeah, it was not a good gray.
Yeah.
We are sponsored this week by Pillow. Getting a good night's sleep is underrated, but with a little help, it can be life-changing. Pillow is an all-in-one sleep tracking solution to help you be more aware of your sleep patterns and discover what might be affecting how you sleep. If you have an Apple Watch, tracking your sleep is as easy as wearing it to bed. Pillow will track and analyze your sleep automatically. One of Pillow's most loved features is the ability to get a detailed heart rate diagram of every sleep session. You can compare your sleep quality with your weight, steps, caffeine consumption, and so many other health metrics to discover how they might be affecting how you sleep. You can enable recording, and Pillow will save the noise sounds that you make during sleep. From sleep talking to sleep apnea, snoring, unexpected noises, anything that might be affecting your sleep, you can use recording and find out. And a lot of users have been surprised by the results. And of course, Pillow is very privacy-minded. All of your sleep and audio data is encrypted and stored on your device. And when it's synced to iCloud, it's using end-to-end encryption. Pillow doesn't have user accounts. You can use it anonymously, and it won't collect or send your personal data anywhere else. Naps boost your focus, creativity, and overall well-being. If you're working from home, you can also take naps using Pillow's power nap modes. And on the Apple Watch with WatchOS 6, Pillow takes advantage of the extended runtime API to minimize battery consumption on the watch when you need an alarm. Pillow is available on the App Store for the iPhone, Apple Watch, and iPad. Discover all of Pillow's features at naybox.com/pillow. That's spelled naybox.com/pillow. Sleep well and stay safe. Our thanks to Pillow for their support of Happy Hour.
All right, let's talk about the iPhone SE now that it's been out for a little bit longer, too. What's new with the discussion around the iPhone SE this week?
Yeah, so speaking of things that are a little bit ridiculous, people have worked out or realized that the iPhone SE, which Apple markets as having all of the features of all the bigger phones, and it's, you know, lots to love, just at lower prices, and it has the A13 chip, and it has, it doesn't have 3D touch, just like the iPhone 11 series, just like the iPhone XR, but and their replacement, like long press, haptic touch, whatever you want to call it, works universally across the system like it would on any other phone, apart from on the lock screen. And on the lock screen, for undiscernible reasons, the iPhone SE does not support the ability to long press on the notification banner and have it expand to give you the rich extended preview with the buttons below. And it's like, why? This is the stupidest thing. Like, it's not a competitive advantage. No one's going to buy the higher, more expensive models just because this one lacks this one random feature. And it's not something that's like a deal breaker, but it, and which is why it doesn't really show up in the reviews that people had last week. But now people are realizing it's like, you know, from time to time, it's pretty convenient to long press a notification, see more information about it.
Instead of swiping it and tapping more, you long press, yeah.
Correct, yeah.
Very nuanced, tap, like, but it's
the
there.
Button, or yeah. You just like press it and it pops up. And that comes back from obviously when in the 3D touch world, you could just like press and you wouldn't have to wait as long. It was just sure. Without the long press.
Yeah, not that you're mad, but yeah.
Yeah. Now, supposedly this isn't a bug and Apple intended to ship this. It's not clear if they intended to ship it, but they're going to add it in the future.
Sure,
right?
Yeah.
And there are a lot of bugs that I've filed on Radar that get ticked off as working as intended, but they're not really fixed. They're just, you know, not designed yet, if you see what I mean. So I think it's insane if they don't put it in the point update or whatever. What's funny is that this is almost like a carbon copy reproduction of the same debate we had with the iPhone XR. And so the XR, but the XR had some like mitigating factors because the XR was the first iPhone that only had haptic touch. It was the first one to drop the 3D touch system. And so when it came out in 2018, everyone was freaking out about, oh, how are you going to do all these random gestures like getting to the trackpad keyboard and opening the quick actions on the home screen? How are you going to do all this without 3D touch? And they answered all those things. But one thing they left out when the iPhone XR shipped was the lock screen notification previews. You had to swipe to the right and then press view to see the extended previews. And it was only in 12.1.1 that they saw sense and then added long press to the lock screen on the iPhone XR as well. So assuming they do indeed add it to the SE in the forthcoming update, maybe even one of these betas of 13.5, it's going to be a complete repetition of the iPhone XR. But at least when the XR did it, it was the first time out. So you could like excuse it as, oh, Apple just forgot to do it here and they're still, you know, working out all the kinks. But now we're like 3 years on from that, and here's the SE, and for no good reason at all, it doesn't support it.
So do I need to buy an iPhone SE just so I can report back on
just
how this goes?
Just one thing. Yeah. And some people are like, oh, it's because the iPhone SE doesn't have... But it does have a haptic... It does have haptic touch response. Like, there's no problem there. And even if it didn't have haptic touch, like the haptic motor, the haptic engine, the iPads do not have haptic engines at all, and they have always supported the ability to long press on notifications to reveal them.
Sure.
So there's just no... explanation, there's no technical reason for it. It's just stupidity or an omission.
And sure, yeah.
If they fix it, I'll call it an omission. If they don't fix it, then it's stupidity.
And if you're upgrading from... So if you're upgrading from an iPhone 6, you never had 3D Touch. If you're upgrading from a 6S, 7, or even 8, because this could be an upgrade target, then
You had it
with 3D Touch, but what happened in 13 with haptic touch?
It still works.
Oh, so there's really no reason for it.
Yeah. It literally works all the way through, and then just randomly, see you later.
Yeah. Okay. So it's gotta be fixed. There's no excuse. What's going on with Ming-Chi Kuo? I know we had a report recently this month.
Yeah, so this is the AirPods thing.
AirPods stuff, yeah.
It's kind of like a little mini like rumor catch-up thing.
This was a fun one because Kuo had
got
the
it wrong.
Yeah, he had the release, and then there was a follow-up email that was like, sorry, I got this part wrong, after we'd already published and lots of people had, you know, assume had. And then there was another email that was like, by the way, this is what we mean about the mistake. Like, there were two follow-up emails about this.
It's hilarious. And the typo was that it said that the AirPods third generation, originally it said, would go into mass production in the first half of 2020. And so that sounded like reasonable, right?
Sure.
Okay, it's the end of the year, it's the fall, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then Kuo sends a correction. He's like, no, that's a typo. It should be the fall of 2021. So, okay. I mean, that makes it more of a news story, right? Because you probably expect an AirPods update this year for the normal ones, right? Because... we haven't had it. We had the AirPods second generation this March last year, and we haven't had any AirPods changes to the normal AirPods this year, right? We had AirPods Pro come out near the end of last year, right? But so technically we're due on a normal schedule for the, you know, the non-noise cancelling AirPods.
And a big part of the report, you know, supply chain report about, you know, who to invest in, is that the second generation AirPods are not selling as well anymore because of the AirPods Pro. And so if you're investing in suppliers for the AirPods, you know, second generation, they're not doing as well as suppliers for the AirPods Pro. And so it did make sense. It was like, okay, so they're going to revive those in some way pretty soon. It's like, no, that's next year. So.
Yeah, so apparently the AirPods Pro aren't getting updated until 2021 as well, according to Kuo.
Yeah, they still seem new though, but you know.
They're newish, right? But still, you could have seen a full update, right, near Christmas. And maybe some of this been pushed back.
As someone who recently replaced theirs because they lost one and then... lost that one and then found that one in the laundry and gifted it to their brother. I was happy they weren't going to be updated.
Yeah, be a bit of a reprieve. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So apparently an AirPods for a year, except for the fact that there was also this rumor about the AirPods Pro Lite that Digitimes have been talking about for a while. And Kuo squashes that and says, okay, we think they are some kind of Beats branded headphone. Maybe it's an update to PowerBeats. Maybe it's something along those lines. Maybe it's a Beats X replacement. Potentially.
Sure,
we don't quite know yet.
Yeah.
But in terms of Apple AirPod branding, no in-ear or over-ear or little buds coming this year. We're still expecting the over-ear full, you know, can headphones from Apple.
And
last week we discussed them getting the little magnetic swap out and being modular and stuff like that. But no earbuds, AirPods anytime soon.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of a shame because I wanted them in black, but...
That wouldn't be a new supply. Like, it doesn't. He's saying no new hardware version, but a color. I don't think would. But equally so, I don't think they're going to do it.
In the past, Kuo has definitely predicted colors pretty accurately.
Yeah, so and they would probably
colors coming. Maybe you'd expect him to say it.
Yeah, if they made the AirPods second generation in black, they in the AirPods Pro weren't. That'd be too bad. But that would pick up the sales that they're talking about. And I was looking around this week, and you can buy, you know, AirPods second generation with the non-wireless charging case cost $159, the same as the first generation AirPods. But Best Buy has, like, for a week at least, had them for $139. You know, and that seems like maybe a better price. Color.
Yeah, so we'll see what the AirPods Pro Lite turn out to be. It seems like they might be the same form factor as AirPods Pro, but they won't have the noise cancelling stuff. They won't have the active noise cancelling. So,
which is what Powerbeats Pro are, you know? Because of this, like the last time Quo kind of dismissed something that was a headline and believed to be happening was when I think the first time that there were rumors of a new iPhone SE. He's like, if there is one,
2.5 years ago.
Now. Yeah, he's like, if there is one, it's so minor that I can't see it. and then there wasn't one. In this case, you know, he thinks this is a Beats product and not an AirPods family of items. So
it'd be interesting to see what price point that ends up at. If it is kind of like AirPods Pro, but no noise cancelling, because the AirPods Pro $249 and then wireless charging AirPod normals are $199. So you'd expect it to be somewhere in that range. But because it's Beats, they can kind of go on a separate price ladder if they have to.
Yeah. But the Powerbeats Pro, there probably needs to be a version of it that's updated with noise cancellation and transparency. And, you know, as you'll remember, the Beats Solo Pro were the first announced product from Apple and Beats to have transparency. You know, it also had their on-ear headphones with noise cancellation and transparency. And then it happened to be also on the same day, you know, but announced like way later that AirPods Pro were a thing and that they would have transparency too. So technically it was announced for Beats first and then launched on the same day as AirPods Pro. But you would.
Because the studios had noise cancellation, but they didn't have transparency.
Right. And I think also it's a different, you know, it's a different way to approach noise cancellation. Anyway,
yeah, it's like next generation version of it. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Remember the studio version? After Apple bought Beats, Bose sued Apple for Beats noise cancellation because it was too similar, and they ended up like settling it. So,
so then they probably had to go back to the drawing board and re-engineer it from scratch.
Yeah, if they don't want to pay like a licensing fee to Bose, you know. So yeah. And then what's going on? I know Mark Gurman at Bloomberg had a cool story with just hardware stuff in general. So
we skipped this a couple of weeks ago just for time. So we're just kind of circling back just to check off the boxes. He confirms a half-size cheaper HomePod is coming this year. He talked about it a bit last year with vaguer definitions about release date, because that's when we talked about it, and he said it had 2 or 3 tweeters rather than the 7 that the big HomePod has. And it's exactly described here as literally a half-size HomePod. So you can imagine how big the HomePod is. You can imagine how big a half-size one of them is, exactly.
But probably not half the price, though.
We don't know what the price point would be. So the current HomePod is $299. If it was half price, it would be $150.
Too low.
Knowing Apple, it would probably be $199.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you look at Apple's competition, like the Echo Plus is like, like $130, $140. So it kind of lines up in that range. Like the Echo, I think the Echo Plus is normally like $130 when it's discounted, but technically the recommended retail price is $170. So if Apple's was $199, and presumably still has better sound quality, because say what you want about the HomePod, it still holds the crown as the best smart speaker with it on sound quality.
Yep. And a pair of two HomePod minis would still be impressive, because when you go to stereo, it gets really good. Yeah. And there's a certain room size where a $700, you know, or $600, however it's priced out, stereo pair of HomePods is just too much.
Yeah, it's excessive.
Yeah, but it's still better. You know, it's really good. And so if you could have that in a minute, you know, a smaller, cheaper size, and especially I think the really cool effect there would be that the stereo pair is even cheaper, you know, too, because it's the savings plus the savings, and it's appropriate for the room size, not excessive.
Yeah, in our kitchen, just for the way the island's laid out and stuff, there isn't really a place that's near a plug to put a full size HomePod, but you know, a half size smaller one could definitely like slot in there somewhere. So I'm in the market for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And on Mark did like a Periscope stream on his Twitter, just like randomly. And he said that basically what happened was, in the wake of the HomePod not doing so well in the market as, you know, Apple probably wanted it to, like it hasn't completely flopped, and it's definitely doing better than the iPod Hi-Fi, but you know, total unit sales are in the low single digit millions, right? So it's nowhere close to any of Apple's other products or wearables, like the AirPods explosion, for instance. And Mark said that after the, you know, like a few months after the HomePod came out, Apple set up this new group and little team that was basically mission objective, quote unquote, save the HomePod. So redouble down on just doing something that can actually bring the HomePod into a wider market. And so the half-size HomePod is part of that, but also it's coming alongside the software changes, like the ability that they're going to support third-party music apps natively on the HomePod, like Spotify. There might be richer third-party native app support, which brings it up to the level of the competition, because you know the Echo speakers and the Google Home speakers, they all support like native apps on the device itself, whereas the HomePod model today basically routes everything through the phone and personal request systems, right? Apart from like music requests or weather. If you go into anything more complicated, like shortcuts, they're all just routed from the phone. So hopefully, alongside the HomePod coming out this year in the new form factor, the HomePod OS update will actually be pretty substantial.
Yeah. Is there anything on rumored about a second generation full size HomePod? Because I know we've seen some stuff in code references and everything, and
there's been nothing concrete.
Yeah. Reason I wonder is the marketing of this. It would make so much more sense if when they've got a cheaper version of HomePod out, that's called HomePod, and then the what we know now as HomePod is like HomePod modifier, because you want the mass audience one to be the thing that's the thing, you know,
but rather than calling it
HomePod Mini
and HomePod today,
because then you kind of get into like the 10R 10S problem where like the mainstream thing is sub
point. That's a fair point. Although I guess people buy like Echo Dots and they don't really have that problem about
People get given Echo Dots, like they just show up.
But, yeah. But I mean, like the mainstream Amazon Echo isn't their most popular model anymore, right? Like, It's the Echo modifier, right? The cheap ones.
I don't think they even have one called Echo anymore. This is all modifiers.
Yeah, because they got the Plus or whatever.
Yeah.
One easy solution, if they want to, they could just rebrand the current HomePod as HomePod Max and then just call the current one HomePod, you know, the new mini one as HomePod if they wanted to.
Yeah, HomePod Plus.
They could, or call it like HomePod Studio or something. They could rebrand it. Like, there's no brand value on the HomePod really, right?
Right, yeah.
The category can still be called a HomePod. The exact product name can probably...
There's precedent for rebranding things too, like Apple TV 4th generation becoming Apple TV HD.
And that was actually makes it sound worse, because HD sounds like something you'd hear in 2010, but like, right. With it anyway, because to line up with the Apple TV 4K.
There's a bunch of stuff here.
In the same report, Gurman also discussed some cool details about the Apple Tags, and specifically it will be a thin, small, sleek puck, which is what we expected. And it will come with, so bundled with, the actual puck itself will be a leather sleeve and a keychain attachment, so you can hook it on your keys directly. And so what we might have thought of things is that Apple would leave to like a third-party accessory market, or maybe there would be accessories that you could just buy on the Apple Store. Apparently, they're going to ship them in the same box as an Apple Tag. So you buy an Apple Tag, it comes in a leather sleeve and it comes with a keychain attachment.
So it won't be cheap.
It won't be cheap. I mean, people who were wanting like $10 tags, I think you're well out. Like, my estimate before was like 50. When I heard they're going to put a leather sleeve on it, I was like, well, that's, 70 maybe. Like, the price just keeps going up for this thing.
They have a few leather accessories that are just overly priced high, like the sleeves for the MacBooks. Those can get very expensive. Another one that reminds me of this in size would be the sleeve for the Apple Pencil. Because if you've got a second generation pencil, you can buy a leather sleeve for it that's not like magnetic or anything. It's just a leather sleeve, a place to put your pencil. Where do you put it? I don't know.
Was it $50?
Yeah, it's just a lot of money. It's not cheap. And it's not, it doesn't have a lot of utility.
Yeah, the Apple Pencil case is probably more money than you'd want to spend on an Apple Tag.
That's a good way to put it.
That's just how Apple's accessories work. It's kind of...
Yeah, but when I think about why they're making these, I mean, you know, because there's Tile, there's other versions of those, but it's got to be the U1 ultra-wideband stuff that's, like, why they're making these. They don't want to wait for Tile to take advantage of the chip in the iPhone, and they think they can do this better, and they've did all the work with Find My and everything. It's like, so you just put it there. But then this is like, you know, that's why they made it. And then like why you won't buy it is because of the price and how they package it.
If it's like 60, 70, I can stretch to getting one, but I can't buy
it. For work.
Just a waste. Yeah. No, I would actually use one.
Really?
Right? Like, yeah. I think one I could actually have a, you know, perfectly legitimate use for. Yeah. But, and that's for, you know, for maybe it being your keys, maybe it might be like laptop bag or something like that, right? For the $50 or $60 price. And that's kind of like the insurance on it. you know, if it's $70 a pop and they don't have bundles or anything cheaper, there's no way you're going to get more than one of them, really. Like, there's the other stuff. Like, to be honest, if I lose my keys, is it really worth losing the $70 tile tag? Like, I don't know. Like, it's not a guarantee you get it back, right? It could just be lost forever if it's in a river somewhere.
There should be a guarantee on it, though. Like, AppleCare.
Yeah, so. Yeah, Apple's going to give you a guarantee. Yeah. Yeah. No, they'll sell you AppleCare on it with theft and loss.
For the tile itself. Not
for the tile, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know how currently, if you want to qualify for AppleCare theft and loss, you have to have Find My iPhone turned on?
Yes.
If you turn off Find My iPhone, you can't qualify for AppleCare
theft
and loss.
Ooh, they'll change it to you have a tile.
You have to have a tag attached to yourself, yeah.
No.
You cannot get AppleCare theft and loss for your MacBook unless you also stick a tag on it. And then finally, this kind of like rumor category, I just wanted to draw attention to an interesting Twitter account, which is Love to Dream, where the first O is like a capital zero. Or I guess that's just a number zero.
That's lead speak, yeah.
That's lead speak, yeah, for sure. And he had posted stuff in March that very accurately lined up with, like, halfway through April, there'd be an iPhone SE. He got the MacBook. He got the MacBook Air in advance. He got the Magic Keyboard in advance. He got the iPad Pro update in advance, including some, like, specific features. So it seems like he knew something along the lines.
And we didn't know about this account, right? Like, it was...
No, I like, saw it at the very end of March as, okay, like, who is this guy, if you know what I mean? But at that point, because he phrases his tweets in this really weird way, and it's also... He's also writing in Chinese, so there's the language barrier as well, mm-hmm, by using Google Translate. Mm-hmm. But all of his tweets that are, like, actually predicting stuff start, like, I'm just dreaming that X will happen.
Oh,
right?
And that's okay. I see.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's not even like
Love to Dream.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess that's his like thing. Yeah. But when we saw it in March, it didn't even look like prediction. Like, it didn't even look like concrete prediction. It's just like some guy like making stuff up and having some fun. Yeah, you know, fair enough. But now it turns out, well, he is actually like making stuff happen.
The dreams are visions.
He's tweeted loads of stuff in the last like month and a half, and you know, we're still treating it with some skepticism because it needs a bit more of a track record to be like secure, but it could turn into an account that we treat with the same esteem as like the Coin account,
Coin,
right? Mm-hmm. But the difference with Coin is Coin's a lot more selective in that he probably only tweets like 10 times a year. Mm-hmm. And Love to Dream must have tweeted like Apple rumors, probably 10 Apple rumors in March alone. And it spans all sorts of stuff from like an underscreen Touch ID on an iPad coming apparently the end of this year, which seems insane in the current environment. An Apple designed game controller before the end of 2021, which would play in with Apple Arcade. Like, loads of like stuff across the board. And even he even has this list of like a, you know, 12 different products that are coming within the next 14 months, apparently. And one of them listed on there is a 12-inch MacBook that runs on ARM. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's the ARM MacBook that we were talking about last week, right? With the A14, with the 12-core processor. Mm-hmm. We'll just have to wait and see whether this stuff plays out or not. But it's interesting for sure.
And the HomePod Lite, yeah.
HomePod Lite, yeah, yeah, yeah. Although that kind of lines up with existing rumors, right?
Yeah, you can populate this with what you hear otherwise. Yeah,
if you kind of like filtered out the noise, the 12-inch MacBook with an ARM chip is kind of like the most specific one on there, and then you've got the Apple Game Controller stuff, which is in a separate tweet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nice.
Yeah. And then just to round out today, we should probably address Apple's earnings.
Yes.
Obviously, we've had all the COVID-19 stuff. They had to withdraw their guidance at the end of Q1, in the middle of the quarter, because the pandemic ensued and retail stores closed, demand went down, everything like that. And so today was Judgment Day, where we got to find out just how bad it was for them in the Q1 quarter, so January through March. And it turns out not so bad. So when they did their guidance, they were expecting between $63 and $67 billion in revenue, which would have been, you know, a blockbuster record for them for that quarter. The reality after they withdrew their guidance was they came in at $58 billion. So it is like $5 billion down from the lower end of the range, but it's nothing like crazy, right? Like, they're a very healthy company to the point that they have announced that they're increasing their dividend and doing a stock buyback. So financially, I don't think they're too worried.
Yeah, I had a comment. I was like, I thought stock buyback was like, you can't do that right now, you know, and not get harassed for it.
Yeah, like, and obviously Apple has more money than anyone else.
They're not taking any relief money. They don't need any loans.
You know, all the companies that are getting harassed for doing stock buyback stuff are the ones that are now currently on the breadline with, you know, running to the government for money.
Yeah.
You know, 3 years ago, they were just buying back their stock using all their available funds. And then a crisis happened. And they didn't have any money to actually respond to it at all. So that's where the criticism is coming for. And so from Apple's perspective, you know, they haven't been loaning money for anyone. They're not in trouble. So I guess they're fine.
They could loan the money, right? Yeah.
Yeah. They could loan money to other people. Yeah. But it seems like they did, you know, iPhone sales were down a bit, but they apparently even set like records with Apple Store sales through online channels, supposedly. Revenue was up 1% year over year. So it wasn't even that terrible if you like look at it on a year over year basis. They said that services like iMessage and FaceTime saw record daily use, which is probably not a surprise. Apple News hit 125 million users, and services again set a new quality record for revenue. Services and wearables were their like shining points, and then Mac sales were up because probably relating into Mac and iPad sales were up because relating into working from home and people buying stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then iPhone sales were, you know, were depressed, but not terribly. And they said in terms of production that they saw issues through February, but by the end of March, they were basically back on track. And there were various questions about, you know, how is Apple going to respond? Can they keep innovating during this crisis? And Cook basically said on the call, look, we launched, you know, new iPads, new MacBooks and iPhone SE. The company is operating as normal. There has been an adjustment period to the working from home lifestyle, but you know, in general, it's kind of business as usual, and we'll have to see. And they didn't provide guidance for the next quarter,
which is unprecedented.
Yeah, which is
right?
Notable, right? Because I don't think they've done. I can't remember the last time they didn't release guidance for the coming quarter. But you know, that's what every company's doing because there's so much volatility at the moment. We don't quite know what's happening, you know, day in day out. So predicting 3 months ahead is kind of stupid. And so at least they can't withdraw this quarter's guidance because they haven't given any. But we'll have to see exactly how bad how good the revenue is for this quarter because, you know, going January through March, most countries outside of China hadn't actually done like lockdown measures until the last like couple of weeks of March, really. Mm-hmm. Right. So for the most of the first quarter, like January was basically unaffected outside of China. February was basically unaffected outside of China. And then you had the supply chain problems come in. And then you had, you know, by the end of March, there was issues with lockdown. And so those would have rolled into April, but that comes into the quarter after the one they've just reported.
Right. And all of iPhone SE sales, if that's a significant number, that's part of the next quarter, right?
Correct. Yeah. Yep. Yep.
And the incentive of giving guidance is you expect it to be positive and you expect it to be growth. And so the guidance is a way to say, keep investing or invest more in Apple the future is bright. And they can't positively give a guidance range that's positive, at least. And so there's no incentive to give guidance. There's still the requirement to give earnings quarterly. And there's interest in making that twice a year. I think in 2018, the president asked the SEC to study what it would, you know, what it would look like if you move from quarterly to just, you know, in the halves of each year.
And Tim Cook has shown support for that kind of motion because he's always complaining about the 90-day cycles and stuff.
Yeah, he doesn't
look in longer term.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe we could get to that point from this.
And if one thing's for sure, Apple loves not telling people anything because we've gone from having unit sales per product to just having revenue per product.
Yeah.
And now we're not even giving guidance on stuff. So who knows? And all their services, stuff, you get just a glom total number.
The bundle.
All of our services, which includes everything from music to news to TV Plus to App Store revenue. You just get one services number and gross margin. That's it. So you get no visibility into like the success of each individual thing. Who knows how many subscribers TV Plus has? Like, they're never going to tell you. And so that's the state of, you know, Apple's financials today. They make enough money and they have enough growth that they don't have to like cave to investor pressure at all. And they're constantly just reeling in the amount of information that they don't tell you.
Yeah. If you want to know those numbers, you've got to try to replace Luca Maestri as the CFO. I'll read some headlines from 9to5 Mac since the earnings, the call with investors started. So a few things that came out from the call itself is usually comments from Tim Cook or Luca Maestri. Apple stores in Australia and Austria will reopen in 1 to 2 weeks. So that's the first time that we'll see, Apple stores outside of China reopen. Nothing there on the US. Tim Cook says that iMessage and FaceTime saw a record daily use, as you mentioned, 125 million news users, as you mentioned.
Not News Plus, by the way. That's just normal Apple News.
Actually. Yeah. They don't say News Plus.
Yeah.
That's too competitive. We couldn't handle how positive
it's too low.
You could surmise though that there were fewer than 125 million News Plus users.
You would be correct. A subset of the 125 million.
Yep.
Probably about 1% of them.
Yep. Apple working on new Apple Card financing options for products other than iPhone. So that's the special arrangement where they've got 0% financing. If you use the Apple Card, they give you the 0% APR. They want to do that for more than the iPhone. So presumably you know, an iPad program, a Mac program. Yeah.
And we saw, and this is what we predicted, right? Because they always used to offer 0% financing through like Barclays,
right,
and other manufacturers and other partners, and other credit card
if
partners.
You spent 800 or 1,000 or 1,200, you know, certain dollar amounts.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we said at the time when the Apple Card was brand new that, you know, they're going to start phasing out all these third-party partnerships to replace it with Goldman Sachs-endorsed Apple Card options. And yep. That's what seems to be happening.
Yep. Tim Cook expects iPhone SE to attract Android users. He says it's faster than the fastest Android phones, which is a headline that went around. So, okay.
Although it does only have 3 gigs of RAM, whereas the iPhone 11 iPhone Pro have 4 gigs of RAM.
Yeah, and that was the last headline. So, not a very newsy one. Again, some quarters we don't talk about earnings, you know?
Like, at all.
We skip it because it's business as usual, and it's like, all right. This time we almost did that, but it's like, well, I mean, there was a big question about what would happen and with the health pandemic, and you know,
the quarter where they had to withdraw guidance is newsworthy enough to do the headlines like we did.
Indeed, yep. Yeah,
like it certainly wasn't catastrophic for them in any way. They're, you know, when you're increasing your buybacks by $50 billion, increasing your dividend, and, you know, investors are pretty happy. The stock's, you know, like up 1% or whatever.
And
Apple's like coming out unscathed.
Yeah. And you know, alongside all that, they've also talked about how many masks they've produced, and you know, so it's not just, you know, business is positive. It's
I think they ship like they obviously talked up all the efforts they're doing to help the world, right? With you know, donations and the collaborations on things like the One World Together at Home like streaming thing. They said 7.5 million face shields they've shipped so far, and they're shipping 1 million a week. So, and they, you know, they're doing all sorts of donations and assistance. Like, not to downplay any of that stuff at
sure,
all, right? Because they are doing a pretty good job at
Did you
being
see
responsive to the world.
Where Amazon reported, I think it was like $4 billion in profit?
Yep.
And that they were going to use all of that and some more to invest in the safety of workers. And it's kind of been like, well, they haven't been the strictest on, you know, making sure that their workers are safe, and their stock price just tanked, you know? That's too bad, but you know, I guess that's
business.
That's business, right? Yeah. But you think, like, you know, we're not going to protect workers. Oh, then that would be bad, you know, because but I guess people are in great supply. There's like no humanity in the market. It's not a factor. Sure. So
yeah, like Tim Cook might not care about the ROI, but the market definitely does.
That's right. All right, a couple of things for me before we wrap up. One is I tweeted recently a picture of two big bags of 9to5 Mac stickers. And basically, if you want to know more about those, then subscribe to my other podcast, 9to5 Mac Watch Time. I'll have a link in the show notes here. Or you can just search for Watch Time or 9to5 Mac in your podcast app and find it. But subscribe if you want to hear about how to get one of those stickers for free. That information will be in a future episode coming up soon, either next week or in 3 weeks. So be sure to subscribe if you want to know about that. And the other thing I want to promote is it's not in Apple Podcasts, but I was on a podcast called Today in Space. And if you want, and it's with a friend of mine named Alex Orfanos. And if you want to hear about why I'm excited about space news and history lately, and why I've done the spaceexplorer.com website, the whole origin is there, and I was listening to it. We recorded like 2 weeks ago, and so it's been a while. So I re-listened, and I was like, after I heard it, I was like, I've kind of been in a funk like in the last 2 weeks, like a little bit down. And
I think that's excusable given what's going on.
Yeah. And so like, listening to that again, it kind of like hyped me back up. It's like, oh yeah. and then there was some cool just space news today that also made me like excited. So spaceexplorer.com.
The thing where the rover or the ship looked like the Four of Mankind ship? That was cool.
Okay. So we had the, an astronaut, who was on an advisor for All Mankind was on this podcast, so that's a thing. Yeah. And
listen to that episode; it's a good episode.
I agree. And he tweeted today that this is the space that I was excited about, and like to get out my energy, I went out and took a walk, you know, to like balance, which has been rare in the last couple of weeks. But NASA's going back to the moon for the first time since the early 70s, the Apollo 17 mission. In the 2020s, they've got this goal of 2024 to send the first woman and next man to the moon. So they've already got the rocket that they'll use and the spacecraft that the astronauts will be in designed, and the contractors building that, and some of it's already built out. The part that was missing was taking, going from like the lunar orbit. So you're like, you know, around the moon. How do you get down there and back safely? And that's the Human Landing System, HLS. And so they want to do this commercially, where they've got competing companies, private companies that are offering different proposals to build that. And so Blue Origin, which is the space company from Amazon's Jeff Bezos, SpaceX, you know, Elon Musk, Tesla, and then another company called, I forget the name of it, I'm not very familiar.
Dynetics or something?
Yeah, Dynetics. And they're a smaller company, or they're not like as flashy in the headlines. But they've got one that looks like what they imagined for all mankind, you know, visually, because all three look visually very different. Like, you, of course, SpaceX is like if Apple designed one, it's, yep. You know, it looks like an airport express tower, extreme tower or something. But this one, yeah, and it's kind of like the most human landing system looking design anyway. And everyone else is kind of thinking out of the box and modern. But yeah, that's what that tweet was.
Yeah, I mean, if For All Mankind had rendered the SpaceX one, people would have said, oh, For All Mankind's being unrealistic.
Yeah, exactly.
So
exactly.
It's always the one that looks like the closer to progression of current technology.
That's right.
Like used to.
That's yeah. Right. And if you want to learn a lot more about the human landing system and the commercial program to create that in NASA, then I got a lot of words written about that on spaceexplorer.com. That's all my promotion for this week. The main thing I want to say is subscribe to Watch Time if you haven't yet, because obviously I know that more people listen to this podcast than that podcast, but that podcast is where I will tell you how to get a free 9to5 Mac sticker, and they're cool. I should have showed you I made some old ones before, and these ones are better than the old ones.
They are so cool. I don't have one.
Yeah. I spent a couple hundred dollars on these. I'll say that.
They look nice.
Two giant bags of stickers. So, all I'll say is in the future, I'll be like handwriting out envelopes and mailing these out in large numbers. So that's that. All right. That is the Happy Hour podcast for this week. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Apollo Zach. Benjamin, you're on Twitter at
BZMAO.
And if you have any feedback for this show, you can email us at happyhour@9to5mac.com. You can send us a message on Twitter or Instagram. And we will be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.